It's wonderful to be here and see old friends and new friends and people that are part of our new group Code Pink, which I'll talk about at the end. But it's also wonderful to be here having come back from a trip that took me to Iraq, Palestine, and Israel, straight to the World Trade Organization in Cancun, New York, to start organizing around the Republican Convention in 2004, and now to LA. And there is certainly a thread to all of this, and that is organizing against the powers that would like to see our world governed solely for the benefit of corporations. And let me start with what happened in Cancun, because it was quite remarkable and I think gives a lot of hope for the future of our work. As you well know, Cancun was the site of the meeting of the World Trade Organization. And while many Americans don't know what the World Trade Organization is, it's probably the greatest threat to world democracy that exists. Because here is an organization that would like to be able to write the rules for the entire planet and say to any local community anywhere in the world, sorry, your sovereignty doesn't mean anything because the rules of the World Trade Organization trump what you do locally, trump what you do nationally, trump any kind of regional agreements, bilateral agreements. It's basically a global constitution written, until many of us activists got involved, behind closed doors in secret. Now, this was exploded in Seattle in 1999 in November when tens and tens of thousands of people came out to expose the World Trade Organization. And in recent years, they've had to go to places like Doha to meet to try to stay away from where the activist community could have access. And this last meeting in Cancun was another attempt to keep the activists away. One, it's quite difficult to get to Cancun, expensive to get to Cancun, and on top of that, it's a long strip that makes it easy for them to have the convention center in one place and then the long, what's called the hotel strip, to put up big barricades all along the way and keep out anybody who wasn't accredited with the World Trade Organization. So an attempt to say to the thousands and thousands of activists that had come from all over the world, we don't care what you say, and we don't want anybody to hear what you say. And that just wasn't the way it worked out. Because our movement has become very sophisticated, even since the time of Seattle. And we have a strategy now of working on the inside and working on the outside. And many of our organizations have become accredited with the World Trade Organization as non-governmental organizations, and so have the right to go inside. Now, this is very tricky for the World Trade Organization because they try to pretend that they are becoming more open, more democratic, allowing non-governmental groups to come inside. Now, they hope that the non-governmental groups would be lobbyists for the rice industry and the corn industry and the soy industry and the pharmaceutical industry. But within that rubric of non-governmental organizations comes groups like Public Citizen, like Global Exchange, like Focus on the Global South, and an incredible coalition that we've put together called Our World Is Not For Sale. And that group would come together every morning, early in the morning, to talk about the latest developments in the WTO, and would come together again late at night to talk about what happened during that day and how we could influence the next day's negotiations. So while our friends, our brothers, our sisters, and comrades were working on the outside, we were working to influence the delegates. And for those of you who don't know that much about the World Trade Organization, the main issue that was on the table was the issue of agricultural subsidies. This is an issue that has been a thorn in the side of the World Trade Organization from the beginning because it shows the hypocrisy of the rich countries. Because the rich countries say to the poor countries, open up your borders, let the free market work, and yet they say that to the poor countries, and then the rich countries themselves keep barriers for other goods to come into their countries, but most of all, they subsidize their own agriculture. They subsidize what has become in this country corporate farming. It's no longer small family farms. Those have been wiped out. It's mainly corporate agriculture using vast amount of pesticides, destroying the land, providing us with food that's barely fit for human consumption, to the tune of $1 billion a day. If you add in the subsidies given to farmers in the U.S. with the subsidies given to farmers in the European Union countries, it comes out to about $1 billion a day. That's our tax dollars going to corporate farmers. Now, everybody knew that in an election year, George Bush was not about to cut the subsidies to the cotton farmers, to the soy farmers, to any of these corporate farmers, because they tend to be people who give generously campaign contributions to the Republican Party. So here they were at a meeting of the World Trade Organization where the poorer countries of the world were saying, your subsidies, the $1 billion a day you're spending to subsidize corporate farming, means that those corporate farms are growing massive amounts of pesticide-laden food, which they are then dumping on our countries. And what happens when that food is dumped on poor countries? It means that millions and millions and millions of poor farmers are devastated. They cannot compete with subsidized agriculture from the rich countries. So farmers that have had their farms for generations upon generations upon generations have seen their family farms wiped out, their communities wiped out, basically rural agriculture disappearing before their eyes. And while we're in Cancun, farmers from all over the world made their way to Cancun to protest what was happening to their communities. And something very dramatic happened that much of the mainstream press in this country ignored. And that was, there was a delegation of 200 farmers from South Korea there to talk about how this subsidized agriculture had destroyed family farming in their communities. And there was one man, Mr. Lee Kwang Ha, who had been organizing farmers for decades, had even gotten elected locally as a government official trying to change government policies to no avail, then went to the headquarters of the World Trade Organization in Geneva and staged a hunger strike and another hunger strike and another hunger strike, trying to bring the world's attention to what was happening to farmers. And there he was in Cancun, where people had not listened for so long. And as he was there addressing the activists about the plight of farmers around the world, he took out his pocket knife and stabbed himself in the heart. His death had a profound impact on the entire World Trade Organization, both on the inside and the outside. And it brought home to those of us there that this was not about arcane language of trade documents. This was about life and death issues for farmers, for people who should be the most honored people in our society because they not only feed their families, they feed our families. And instead of being given a place of honor in our global community, they're being devastated. And Mr. Lee gave the ultimate of sacrifices to bring this issue to world attention. And in doing so, he was speaking not only for Korean farmers, he was speaking for the 20,000 Indian farmers who have committed suicide in recent years when they are faced with loss of their farms, when they are faced with a company like Monsanto that is trying to steal the very essence of life, the seeds, and force farmers to buy seeds every year from a multinational corporation. And Mr. Lee was speaking for farmers in the United States who have been wiped out, like black farmers who have become an endangered species in this country. And he was speaking for French farmers like José Bozvay, who drove a tractor through the McDonald's when they started to build one in his hometown, saying McDonald's does not sell real food made by real farmers. We don't need or want McDonald's in our community. Or like he did more recently with other French farmers and went and took up the fields of an experimental farm that was growing genetically modified foods to say, we don't need, we don't want, we will not allow genetically modified foods to destroy our farm communities. Mr. Lee was speaking for farmers around the world. And while he had a tremendous impact on the outside, I think he also had a tremendous impact on the inside of the negotiations. Because, you know, in a post-9/11 atmosphere, it's been very difficult for countries to stand up to the United States. It's always been very difficult because of the economic clout. But after September 11th, it's been even more difficult for countries. But here we had an amazing phenomena happen at the World Trade Organization. And that was that poor countries, countries representing poor farmers like Brazil, like India, like South Africa, like Malaysia, stood up. And they started to organize. And first they organized in what was called the G21, 21 countries coming together. And then every day we heard another country entering, Egypt, Kenya, countries that represented 85% of the world's farmers. And finally, it wasn't G21 or G22 or G23, it got up to G29. And this was at the very same time that George Bush himself was calling the heads of states of these countries and saying, don't join the G21. Giving them carrots of saying, we will enter into bilateral negotiations with you and you will get a good deal for your people. Don't join the G21. And if the carrots didn't work, then going to the stick and saying, we know how much the U.S. is giving you in aid every year. Remember that, because you might not be getting it the next year. Despite the arm twisting, despite the arrogance, despite the bullying, the countries stayed together and grew. And in the last day of the negotiations, when the world expected, just like in the Doha round, that there would be an agreement because of all this arm twisting, because of how difficult it is to stand up to the rich countries. Surprise, surprise, the poor countries walked out and they said, there will not be any negotiations. We will not agree to a deal that continues to devastate our farm communities, continues to put the rights of corporations above the rights of people. It was the best outcome that we could have imagined for those talks, a stalemate. And it was the best tribute to the life and death of Mr. Lee. And I think we should take heart in the developing countries standing up to the United States under such difficult circumstances and recognize that this represents something new in the history of world trade negotiations. And hopefully this kind of empowerment of poor countries will carry through in November when the negotiations take place for the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas in Miami. It is our hope that this kind of empowerment is not a one-time thing. And I think what will make the difference is if we in the United States stand together with people in the poor countries around the world and say that we refuse to give in to a world governed by corporate greed, that the world we want is a very, very different one, and we are determined to build that different one, and that we will not let corporations and their arm in the military determine the future of our planet. And that takes me to what's happening in Iraq, because in Iraq you see in the most raw, brutal form how the forces of military domination and economic domination go hand in hand. As Thomas Friedman said, someone we might not agree with on many issues, but certainly agree with what he said about the hidden hand of the free market cannot function without the hidden fist. In the case of Iraq, it's not the hidden fist of the military. He said, you can't have McDonald's without McDonnell Douglas. And in Iraq, what we see is the military domination. But what we fail to see, or what our media fails to tell us, is what's happening in the economic domination. Many of us always thought this was a war about oil. Perhaps what we didn't realize is how profound a war it was to remake Iraq and then the rest of the Middle East in the eyes of the Western corporations. To take a country and totally devastate the local economy and turn it into one that will be an example of the absolute domination of the free market. And that's what they are trying to do in Iraq today. Iraq, a country that is devastated by 3 decades of a brutal dictatorship, a dictatorship that took them into devastating wars in Iran and Iraq and then in Kuwait, and then 13 years of absolutely inhumane sanctions, so that what once was a thriving middle-class society had been brought to its knees. And then the final blow was the invasion. You remember them talking about the targeted attacks. And while I was here speaking after the invasion of Afghanistan and said, don't believe those smart bombs, they're not smart, they hit all kinds of civilians, I was amazed at what I saw in Iraq, because they were extremely targeted bombing. And you would go through areas of Baghdad and see residential neighborhoods totally standing, and there was a government building, and the government building targeted, hit, precision bombing. And you go throughout the city of Baghdad and you'd see the, quote, precision bombing that hit the different ministries. And these were supposedly ministries that represented the tyranny of Saddam Hussein. Well, some of them certainly did, like the Ministry of Defense. But what about the Ministry of Public Education? What about the Ministry of Health? What about the Ministry of Transportation? Were these the epitome of Saddam Hussein, or was that the infrastructure that had kept a country barely functioning? And I'd say it was the latter. And so when you damage individual buildings that happen to be the buildings that represent the basic infrastructure of health, of education, of commerce, transportation, you've destroyed the entire infrastructure of a country. The phone system. The phone system was not keeping Saddam Hussein in power. The phone system was allowing Iraqis to talk to each other. Devastated the entire phone system and didn't to this day even try to rebuild the phone system so that Iraqis still can't talk to each other. The electrical grid. Devastating the electrical grid and to this day not putting it back online. And the Iraqis say, why was it that this powerhouse of the United States that has the most incredible technology that can precision bomb buildings from thousands and thousands of feet in the air can't get the electricity back online? And how come under Saddam Hussein's corrupt regime, corrupt state apparatus, 40 days after the electrical grid was destroyed in the Gulf War, the electricity was up and running again? Why is it that the United States is not rebuilding what it destroyed? That's a question that every Iraqi we met with asked again and again and again. Why no electricity? Why no running water for us? And recognize that the United States government planned to the day of the attack, while they had us running around and running around saying weapons inspections and U.S. Security Council, and had ourselves hitting our heads against the wall thinking we could really stop this invasion if we mobilized. And we mobilized. We mobilized beautifully around the world, and we couldn't stop it because they had already planned it. And they planned it to the exact month and the day they wanted to start the invasion because they didn't want it to be too hot for the U.S. troops. And after they went in and invaded and didn't put the electricity back online, who was the one suffering? Yes, the U.S. troops were suffering, but the ones really suffering were the Iraqis. In 110-degree heat, 120-degree heat, no electricity, no fans in their homes, no running water because the electrical pumps weren't working, no gasoline for a country that is floating on oil because they didn't have the generators to pump the gasoline. And so you have people who are standing online in 110, 120-degree weather, not for 4 hours, not for 5 hours, sometimes for 24 hours a day to get gasoline in a country that has the second largest gas reserves in the entire world. What sense does that make? How do you think Iraqis felt standing on those gasoline lines, knowing that what the U.S. wanted and what the U.S. was going to do was to steal their oil? So here, the United States comes in, devastates the infrastructure of the country, No electricity, so how can businesses be functioning? On top of that, dismisses the entire police force. So there is no law and order. There is chaos in the streets. What does that mean for businesses? Would you like to have a business where you couldn't turn on the lights in the morning and you didn't know if somebody was going to come in with a gun and shoot you and steal all your stuff because there was nobody to stop them from doing it? Devastating to local businesses. On top of that, one of the first decrees by the head of Iraq right now, who is Paul Bremer, was to lift all tariffs on goods coming into the country, so that Iraq was suddenly flooded with imported goods that businesses couldn't compete with. Sounds like what I was just talking about with the WTO, doesn't it? And so you go into the few Iraqi stores that are open, and you can't find Iraqi goods anymore. I went in with a woman who wanted to show to me what had happened in just 5 months' time. She tried to buy a headscarf from Iraq. Always bought her headscarves from Iraq. She couldn't find one. They were all from China. Tried to buy a can of tomato paste from Iraq. She always bought her tomato paste from Iraq. Couldn't find a can of tomato paste. It was coming in from Jordan. A bar of soap. Couldn't find a bar of soap made in Iraq. It was coming from Turkey. Flooded with goods from the outside. In the meantime, remember them talking about the looting? And Donald Rumsfeld called it untidiness and said, with democracy comes some untidiness. Let me tell you about that untidiness. First, the U.S. bombs all these major ministries and then either looks the other way or allows the looting to start. And the looting then takes on a life of its own. And those who enrich themselves with the looters become the new mafia. And they have guns and nobody can stop them. And they're not just petty thieves stealing things to feed their families. There are plenty of those as well. But there are big-time looters now who have gone into the few functioning factories and stolen every piece of major equipment. And what do they do with them? They spirit them out of the country. And who is controlling the borders? The U.S. Army. Does the U.S. Army stop them? Not at all. And so you have cement mixers, and you have industrial rigs and cranes and all kinds of equipment worth $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 being stolen right under the noses of the U.S. forces and being taken out of the country. Another example of devastation of the local economy, making it impossible for people to take care of themselves. The Bush administration said that Saddam Hussein's regime was a value-destroying regime. And yes, it was a brutal dictatorship. But as part of that regime, there was free education all the way through graduate school, a very well-educated society. There was basically free health care. And there was a ration system in place that was put because of the sanctions to stop people from starving. And so every single person in Iraq, 24 million people, were entitled to a monthly ration to keep them from going hungry. That, in the eyes of the Bush administration, is a value-destroying economy. So their plan is to lift the ration system, to end that ration system, because people shouldn't get handouts. They should rely on the free market. So you have a dysfunctional economy, and they want by the end of the year to cut off the ration that really has meant the difference between eating and non-eating for millions of Iraqis. That is part of a value-creating system. Well, who is supposed to come and teach the Iraqis how to create a value-creating system? People from the United States. So dismiss massive numbers of people. There is an unemployment crisis right now in Iraq because the U.S. came in and dismissed thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Start out first with the army, 400,000 people in the army. Now, this is an army that received so much propaganda from the United States before the invasion that had millions of leaflets dumped on them, had radio stations like the Voice of America saying, don't fight and you will be rewarded. Don't fight and the brutal regime of Saddam Hussein will be gone, the sanctions will be lifted, and lives will be better for you and your people. And guess what? The Iraqi army listened. Because one, they hated Saddam Hussein because he had taken them into these devastating wars in Iran, Iraq, and Kuwait. And they had seen so many of their lives, of their comrades, fallen for nothing. And two, they knew they couldn't beat the United States because of its technology. And three, they believed the propaganda. So en masse, they took off their uniforms and they didn't fight. So the U.S. came in and said, oh, this was easy. We won the war against Saddam Hussein. And didn't turn around and say, and thank you, those of you in the army who didn't fight. Well, these army people thought they were going to be greeted as allies by the United States. Maybe even as heroes. But instead of that, they found that they had lost their jobs. They had lost any way to feed themselves, and each one had an average family of five people. That's 400,000 times five. That's 2 million people right there. No way to feed themselves. And people very angry. 400,000 people who had been trained in war, trained to fight, very angry. Not a very smart move. On top of that, they had a de-bathification program, supposedly to get rid of people who had been collaborators with the regime of Saddam Hussein. All very well and good, except who did they focus on? Unfortunately, lower-level collaborators with Saddam Hussein were thrown out of their jobs by the tens, by the hundreds of thousands. And this included teachers, this included professors, this included engineers, this included people who could fix the electrical system, who could get the telephone lines up and running again. But no, they're now standing on street corners yelling about the United States without access to jobs, without a way to take care of their families, and without a way to revive their own economy. And I have a friend who is an engineer, and his son goes to a high school. And there he found that his son's favorite teacher, who is his English teacher, was fired because he was a member of the Ba'ath Party. Well, this friend of mine was very angry and went home and said that he decided he was going to defy one of the decrees of Paul Bremer, which says you're not allowed to display pictures of Saddam Hussein. And so he instantly went to a computer and printed out and enlarged a big picture of Saddam Hussein and put it up in a very prominent place outside his home. And he said it wasn't just any picture of Saddam Hussein, it was a picture of Saddam Hussein shaking hands with Donald Rumsfeld. And he said, when Donald Rumsfeld came here in 1982, I am sure Donald Rumsfeld had access to Amnesty International reports that showed what a brutal dictator Saddam Hussein was. In fact, in 1983, it was the height of the brutality of Saddam Hussein. I'm sure that he had access to Human Rights Watch reports. And in fact, I'm sure he had access to State Department reports that said year after year what a brutal dictatorship Saddam Hussein was. And yet, despite that, here he comes to Baghdad, shakes hands with this man, and says, this is a man we can work with. So my friend says, if we are going to start by dismissing from their jobs and jailing people who were collaborators with Saddam Hussein's regime, please don't start with my son's English teacher in high school. Let's start with Donald Rumsfeld. Let's start with Dick Cheney. Let's start at the top. So here you have the United States coming in, getting rid of huge numbers of people who know how to rebuild their own society, making them now the growing class of the unemployed and the angry, and then you bring in people from the U.S. to run the country. Now, who is brought in? You all know that George Bush himself is a failed Texas businessman, and he brought in his buddies, other failed Texas businessmen, to run the country of Iraq. And these are failed Texas businessmen because, just think, if you were a successful Texas businessman, I don't think you'd want to be relocated to Iraq. So here he brings all his buddies in the Republican Party. They set up shop in what was called the Republican Palace of Saddam Hussein, is now the Republican Palace of George Bush. And they are the ones that are dictating how this country is going to be run. Now remember, these are people who had never been to Iraq before, probably never had a passport in their lives. These are people who don't know anything about the culture, the history, the thousands of years of history of this incredible country that was the birthplace of civilization. Don't speak the language, don't even bother to speak the language, barely go outside the bubble of the presidential palace. And they're the ones that are dictating what is going to happen to the economy of Iraq. And one of the things that they are trying to do as fast as they can is to change the investment laws of Iraq before there is a new constitution written and before there is an elected government, so that no matter who comes into place, they will be straddled with an investment law that is dramatically different than the one that existed under Saddam Hussein, which said that Western companies could not invest in Iraq. So they want to make it that investment, that Western investors can not only invest, but that they can own anything in Iraq. And there are 192 companies that they have now put on the block as part of companies that should be privatized. And of course, the prize in oil in all of this is oil. So here you have the U.S. trying to dictate, before any kind of election can take place, that this will be a country that is run by Western corporations. Well, what are the Iraqis saying to this? The Iraqis are saying, we suffered way too long and we've been quiet way too long. We will not allow this to happen any longer. And that's where I come to the positive part of all this, because there are Iraqis who are fighting back. And while we're hearing in this country only about the armed resistance to the U.S. occupation, we're not hearing about the nonviolent resistance to U.S. occupation. And that's what we are setting up in Iraq, is an organization through a new center we've created called the Occupation Watch Center to be supporting the nonviolent resistance movement in Iraq. And when I say we, I say those of us throughout the world that work so hard to try to stop the war are now coming together to work together to set up this Occupation Watch Center. We now have a center in Baghdad. We have an international board that includes people from Thailand, from India, from Italy, from Canada, from the U.S., from the Arab world, and from Iraq, who are coming together to say we will together not only monitor what is happening in the occupation, put pressure on the occupying forces to stop the abuses, but work together to end the occupation. So let me tell you a little about what the Occupation Watch Center is doing. One of the areas is the area of human rights. Every day there are Iraqis that are being rounded up, detained, thrown into the very prisons that were built by Saddam Hussein, not given any charges, not have access to any lawyers, not even telling their family members where they are. This is happening on a regular basis, just like it happened in the United States after September 11th, just like it happened in Guantanamo with people languishing in prison with no charges. And we are going to those prisons and we are demanding the names of the people being held. We are demanding that they be charged. We are demanding that they have access to lawyers. We are demanding that either they are charged and tried or they are let go. And then there is the issue of the indiscriminate use of force that goes on every day. We hear about the soldiers that are being killed, and it is a tragedy that U.S. soldiers are put in harm's way by this Bush administration and being killed, being shot at every single day. But what we don't hear about is those soldiers who are so frightened that they go along the streets of Iraq with their machine guns pointed straight at the population. And any time they hear gunshots that might be directed at them and might not be directed at them, it might be, as is often the case, a wedding party. Or when Iraqis go to the checkpoints and are told by soldiers yelling at them in English that they don't understand, stop, get out, do this, do that, the soldiers are frightened. And so they shoot. And they shoot indiscriminately into the population. And every day people are being hurt by those soldiers using indiscriminate force. We don't hear about that. There is one hospital alone in Baghdad, the Al-Kindi Hospital, said that every day they get 20 to 30 cases of people with gunshot wounds by U.S. soldiers. Why don't we read about that in the papers? Why don't we see that on television? So we in the Occupation Watch are working with new Iraqi organizations, human rights organizations that sprang up after the U.S. invasion to uncover the misdeeds of Saddam Hussein, all the brutal killings that happened under the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, and find that unfortunately they have to put that work on hold because they have to stop the brutality of the occupying forces. And so they are joining with us and going to the Pentagon, going to the U.S. military, bringing the families of the victims and saying, you must stop shooting at Iraqi civilians. You must stop the indiscriminate use of force. The other thing we're doing as part of the Occupation Watch Center is working with women. Most people in this country are under the misguided impression that Iraqi women were like women under the Taliban in Afghanistan, covered up, not allowed to go to school, barely going outside their homes. Very, very, very different situation in Iraq. Iraqi women, way before the time of Saddam Hussein, had fought for many rights and had won many rights. Iraqi women have been doctors, have been professors, have been engineers for decades. Iraqi women have been judges. Iraqi women have been women selling in the marketplace. Iraqi women have been buying in the marketplace. Iraqi women have been fighting for their rights for many, many years and made very many gains. And then came this invasion. And with the lack of law and order, with the wild, wild west atmosphere where anybody could go to the black market and buy a gun, but there weren't police to protect anybody, there started to be a new spate of rapes and abductions. And women became fearful of even venturing out in their homes. And you see very few Iraqi women now out on the streets. You see very few Iraqi women in the marketplace. You see very few Iraqi women going out unless it is absolutely essential for them to go out. And yet there are groups of Iraqi women who are coming together and saying, we cannot live like this. We will not live like this. And they are starting to organize. And when I was in Iraq 3 weeks ago, just the day after we got there, there was a protest organized by a group of Iraqi women that went right to that square where you saw on television over and over and over again the statue of Saddam Hussein being tumbled. They went to that square because it's a very important square, a very meaningful square in Baghdad. And they went there to protest the lack of law and order, the absolute fear in which they now live, demanding more security for women, and demanding that women have a place in this new society. Outspoken against the fact that of the 25 people hand-selected by the United States in this new governing council, there were only 3 women. And not women who had had a history of standing up for women's rights. Protesting the fact that there is a new committee that is now writing the constitution for the new Iraq, and there are no women as part of that committee. So here were these brave women going out to what's called Firdous Square to protest what has become of Iraqi women and to demand their rightful place in the society. And lo and behold, they get there and the U.S. troops come up. And the U.S. troops come up heavily armed with their guns and they come up to the main organizer and they say to her, don't you know that one of the first decrees is that you can't have a protest without a permit, and where is your permit? And this Iraqi woman, who is a little smaller than me, went up and stood up to these huge soldiers and said to them, you are asking me for a permit in my country? She said, do you realize whose country you are in? She said, where is your permit for you to be in my country? And you should have seen these huge guys just wither away. And we went on with the protest. These are the kind of women that are creating the new Iraq. In fact, we were bringing 2 of them here to the United States in a couple of weeks. They will be coming here to Los Angeles as well. And we know that Code Pink will be organizing furiously so that as many people as possible can meet these very feisty, wonderful women. And in fact, it is women who are running the Occupation Watch Center in Iraq. Iraqi women who are putting their lives at risk every single day to go out and find out the truth about what is happening in their own country and report it to the rest of the world. And I encourage you to log on to our website, occupationwatch.org, and read the reports that they're sending us. And recognize that when you are reading those reports, those are being written by people like these Iraqi women who are doing it at everyday risk to their lives. But they're doing it with great love, and they're doing it with great dedication. And what gives them hope is that they're doing it together with us. They know that there are many people out there in the world, including here in the United States, that are unhappy with what's happening. And they say that there is strength in our numbers and in our determination. And I agree with them. I think the tide is beginning to turn, and I think the quagmire that has become Iraq is the Achilles heel of the Bush administration. Unfortunately for the Iraqis, in the meantime, things will not get better for them. Things will get worse. We have to get the word out about what is happening in Iraq. We have to get the U.S. troops out of there. Many Iraqis hate the United Nations because they say it's the United Nations that imposed 13 years of brutal sanctions on us. But they recognize that there is no alternative. They say we hate the United Nations, but we hate the U.S. worse than that. And they want to see U.S. troops out, United Nations troops in there, and a quick transition to Iraqi self-rule. That is the only answer. They say, look, we have thousands of years of civilization in our country. Your country has 200 years and you haven't gotten it right. Who are you to tell us how to run our country? And so we have to work hard to get the U.S. troops out of there. And believe me, the U.S. troops want to get out of there. They are our allies in this struggle. And while they have a gag order now and are not allowed to talk, believe me, when you talk to them on the side, and we told them about the Occupation Watch Center, they say, right on, anything you can do to help get us out of here, we love you for it. They say, here's the number of my mother, here's the number of my wife, here's the number of my fiancé. Please have them work with you. And I hope you know about the group here in the United States called Military Families Speak Out that has been working so hard to get the voice of dissent within the military families out to the mainstream public and doing an absolutely fantastic job. They are our allies in this struggle. And we hope to be organizing a group of military families to Iraq very soon to meet with the Iraqi people and to show them that we are at one with wanting Iraqis to be in charge of Iraq. That we don't want our tax dollars, the $87 billion more that the Bush administration has just asked for, to go to putting our young men and women in harm's way in a country where they don't want to be, in a country where the people don't want them, in a land we should never have invaded in the first place. And look at what that $87 billion is supposed to go for. Not the rebuilding of Iraq, not to give to the Iraqi people for undoing the tremendous damage that we did to their country. First of all, the vast majority of that money is going just to keep the troops there. Only 17% is supposed to be for, quote, rebuilding Iraq. And where's that going to go? Halliburton, Bechtel, U.S. corporations that are already the second invasion of Iraq, the corporate invasion of Iraq. We should demand an end to the money going to the Bechtels and the Halliburtons and the other war profiteers and say, not a penny for war profiteering. The U.S. must give money to Iraq to rebuild the damage that it created, but it must give that money to the Iraqis because the Iraqis can do the work. They don't need Bechtel to rebuild their schools, to rebuild their hospitals. They know damn well how to rebuild their own country. They also know how to rebuild their pipelines, to rebuild their ports. They are a sophisticated people. You can find engineers on any street corner in Baghdad, unemployed, with nothing to do. They're the ones that should get the money to rebuild their country. So we have a chance right now to make common cause with all the people in this country that are suffering from the budget cuts, suffering from the $350 billion of tax cuts for the rich. On top of that, the billions and billions and billions of dollars being put into this ugly, devastating war machine. And it is time for us to make common cause with the people who are suffering in their own communities because the schools that their children go to are falling apart, because there aren't public hospitals when their parents get sick, because when they go to take a bus, the bus routes have been cut down because of budget deficits. When they want to take their kids to the park in the summer, they find the parks are closed, the libraries are closed. These are all related to what is happening in Iraq, and we must say no to the $87 billion. And we must say to our Congress people who have failed us so miserably by failing to stop this war, it is time for them to get a spine. It is time for them to stand up to the Bush administration. We don't want them saying, no, we want to examine where this $87 billion is going to. We know where it's going to. Having troops being killed every single day in Halliburton and Bechtel, we don't want our money going there. We have to say no. And we have a chance in November 2004 to make sure that the same thing happens to this Bush as the last one, that he is a one-term president. So let me say that this is our moment to show the rest of the world that we do care, and we care enough to liberate ourselves from the Bush administration, the corporate agenda represented by that administration, by the WTO. And we have a chance to do it November 2004. I just came from New York, where groups are already organizing for the Republican convention because they are so angry that the Republican Party has chosen their city, the sacred site, ground zero of the World Trade Center, to come and peddle their convention and peddle the fear that the American people feel about terrorism and use that to their political advantage in such a crass, disgusting way. And the people of New York are already organizing to say, that is not fair. That must backfire on you, Mr. Bush. We will not allow you to use us in such a way. And just like on February 15th, we organized around the world and had the most amazing demonstrations where millions and millions and millions of people came out with one beautiful slogan saying, the world says no to war. What a beautiful thing for the world community to say. Now we have a chance at the start of the convention, August 29th, 2004, to organize globally with one message, the world says no to Bush. Because the world is saying no to Bush. There are two worlds right now. Like the New York Times said on February 17th, there are two superpowers, the United States and global world opinion. And let me tell you, the rest of the world does not see and hear what Fox News is feeding to the American people. The rest of the world hears something very, very different, a little more akin to the truth. And when they hear the truth, they are vehemently opposed to the Bush administration, not to the American people, to the Bush administration. But let me tell you, they are giving us the benefit of the doubt, and they won't keep doing it for very long. Because we have until November 2004 to show the rest of the world that we can organize, that we can mobilize, that we can come together as Democrats, as Greens, as Independents, as people who are totally cynical and disgusted with this electoral system. But we will come together at this time, come together and defeat the Bush agenda. So I want to leave on a hopeful note because I see people resisting in the depths of the devastation of Iraq, like the women that I mentioned to you. And I came to LA and I see Code Pink and it just makes me smile. I mean, look how beautiful these women are. And what you were doing in the California recall election is quite extraordinary. To have someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger even be taken as a serious candidate for this important, beautiful, wonderful state of California is an affront to every single one of us. So I encourage you to join with Code Pink that has done beautiful actions like when Arnold Schwarzenegger opened his campaign and there was it across the street from the campaign headquarters, they unfurled a 40-foot pink slip in the shape of a piece of lingerie that said, Arnie, you're terminated, and have been dogging him throughout the city anywhere he goes. Please join Code Pink in its actions to tell the people of California that we do not want a groper. We are counting on you, the people who helped try to stop this war, the people who are trying to stop George Bush, and the people who are trying to stop Arnie Schwarzenegger, to help us in our organizing work. Because the only way we can do this is by having more staff people, more organizing, more activity, more mobilizing, and we need your support. So please, let's all think about what we can do between now and the elections in California to make sure that Arnold Schwarzenegger, unfortunately for you all, stays in Hollywood but keeps far away from Sacramento. To see what we can do before the elections in November 2004 to make sure that the American public understands what a threat George Bush is to not only us here in the United States but around the world, and to build creative, wonderful organizations like Code Pink that we can be very proud of and hold our heads up high and show the rest of the world that we are indeed mobilizing, organizing, another world is possible, and we are in the midst of creating it. Thank you all so much for coming today.